Welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside Room, today's speaker is Jeannie Olson, and we'll be speaking on the subject of gifts and blessings for and from the dying. Let's listen in on Jeannie.
I have to credit Holden for this particular class because when I was here 2 years ago in the summer, I was in the bookstore and picked up this book that I have up on the top of the board called Final Gifts, and thought it looked really interesting. And it's out of this book that this class comes, and so I have to thank Holden for it. And I must say that this little paperback book has influenced my ministry as a hospital chaplain more than any other one thing besides my initial training when I became a chaplain. And it has powerfully addressed the idea of ministry to the dying for me. And as I read and wept through this book and started applying some of what I learned in this book to my ministry as a chaplain, I decided that, in fact, this was my next project, because I decided there was no reason that only a hospital chaplain or a hospice nurse, and the two women that wrote this are hospice nurses, should know how to listen to a dying patient. And that there's no reason that all of us shouldn't know how to listen to that language, how to listen to that communication, and even though it might be symbolic and seemingly incoherent, that we should be able to meet the needs of that dying person and alleviate their fears. And in the end, if we have the privilege of being at their bedside when they die, to be able to talk them through their transition from this world to the next. So that's what I'm going to cover. And I can almost guarantee you that having taken and sat through this hour of class, or if you pick up this book and buy it and read it, and put into practice what you have learned or what you have read, that if you have the privilege of sitting next to a dying person, that you will be transformed. You will be transformed using these tools and this understanding that your whole idea of death and your whole feeling about the experience of sharing it with someone and helping someone through it will be a blessing to you and will transform your feelings about death. The background is, the dying that I'm going to talk about today is from progressive illnesses and terminal illnesses like cancer, AIDS, people with chronic lung problems. It's not the sort of death that you have in an instant with a sudden heart attack, for example, or a motorcycle accident or an automobile accident. Death, in this other book that I have put up on the board, Into the Light, A Simple Way to Pray with the Sick and Dying, and I didn't ask them to order this because I thought it would be a smaller group that might want it. This is very good, especially for pastors or hospital chaplains. But in this book, Ron DelBene says, I no longer see death as an event, but a process, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. People who have cancer, for example, often have a long-term dying process. And one of the things that these authors in The Final Gifts, Maggie Callahan and Patricia Kelly are their names, is they coined a new phrase. And that phrase is nearing death awareness. And these two hospice nurses and the other hospice workers that they worked with noticed that there were several reoccurring themes and events that happened in their dying patients, especially their cancer patients. And so what I'm going to do is right now is kind of summarize what I'm going to cover today. And one of the things that they saw so many times in their patients is that their patients, while they were experiencing getting closer and closer to death, would have glimpses of another world, for example. Or would see people that we can't see, religious figures, angels, other people that have died. Or they would request something that they needed to have happen so that they could die peacefully. Sometimes they needed a reconciliation with someone. Sometimes they needed an event to pass before they could die. Sometimes they needed to be alone. The tricky part is that sometimes they start talking in symbolic language that sounds to us who are sitting there as just kind of incoherent gibberish. We might just say, oh, he's confused, or she's had too much morphine, or this seems to be happening all the time now, and mom isn't making any sense. So we're going to look at how to listen to the dying person, how to weigh their gestures and the meanings of those gestures, how to avoid alienating and frustrating them. Because the more we don't understand their communication, they get heightened frustration and feel alienated from the people around them. The founder of hospice, a Dr. Saunders, said, and I quote, "You matter until the last moment of life. We will do all we can not only to help you die peacefully, but to also live until you die." And I think that's key in saying, I'm going to try and understand what you're trying to tell me. There's four areas of comfort that we want to give a dying person. The first area of comfort is the physical. And of course, that's left to the doctors and the nurses. But we who have the privilege of being at the bedside, whether that be family or professional staff or loved ones, friends, the other three areas are the emotional area of comfort, the social, and the spiritual. And those are more subtle, and they're more difficult to define, and they're more difficult actually to ease. That's why we have to listen and we have to watch. This is an important place to say that we never want to force our own, or I wouldn't want to force my own concept of how a person should die on the person who's dying. We need to be led by the person who's dying. We have to listen to their ideas, and that takes precedent over anything else. The saddest story I have about dying is about an acquaintance of mine, a friend but not a close friend, who was dying of cancer about 15 years ago, long before I read this book. And she found out that she had breast cancer, and she was a powerful woman of prayer and a Christian, and decided that she was going to be healed solely on prayer. So she took it to her charismatic prayer group. I believe in prayer, but that's all she did. And the breast cancer kept growing. She then decided to go to a hospital in Chicago where they work a lot with herbs and food and vitamins and so on. And I can attest to the fact that my mother is alive today because of herbs and vitamins and food like that. But that isn't the only thing my mother did. She also had two operations. Well, she went through this and metastasized and went to the bone. So she was getting worse and worse. The bottom line is she ended up in hospice. And when I was going to visit her, my other friend who was closer to her said, "Jeannie, whatever you do, don't say anything about the fact that she's dying." And I said, "What? She's in hospice. She's dying." And she said, "I know, but she still believes that she is going to be saved by a miracle so that God can show others that she's a living testimony that miracles and prayer do happen." So I went to visit her in this hospice unit, and she was surrounded by her husband and her two daughters and her son. And it was the worst scene I have ever experienced. I do believe that in almost 95% of all cancer cases, pain can be controlled. She was thrashing in bed like she was wrestling with death itself, and no amount of pain medication could help her. And there stood her family saying, "Mom, you're going to be okay. It's just kind of a bump in the road. You're going to get better. Keep holding on, Mom. Keep praying, etc., etc." You get the picture. It was awful. She denied her death until her last breath. And the thing that happened after that is that the family members who were going through the grief had the most unhealthy grief, because they were all stuck in this denial and not able to talk amongst themselves or with their mom or with any of them about what was really going on. However, you know, the bottom line is the dying person calls the shots. It's their death, and they get to do it how they want to. I hadn't, as I said, read any of this, but I knew it was the worst scene that I had ever experienced, and I knew it was the most unhealthy. So what if the patient's in denial, the spouse is angry, the daughter's depressed, the son is bargaining, and the friend is kind of accepting, and you walk into the situation? You don't try and fix it. Whatever you do, you don't try and fix it. You keep quiet and you listen. And you let everybody talk about where they are. Because that's what they need to do. Have someone who's going to sit there and listen to them talk about where they are in this process of their loved ones dying. So we don't give advice, we don't give solutions, we just listen. And the dying person is probably, most people aren't going to be like this acquaintance of mine, the dying person is probably going to choose a couple well-chosen people. They're not going to choose someone who walks into the room and prattles on about the weather and their latest event in their life. They're not going to choose someone who's afraid of death and talking about dying, because they're going to sense that. But they will choose a person who will listen and hear their pain. They'll choose someone who will listen to them with understanding and not judge whatever they say about their death. And they won't choose someone who will force the topic on them, I'm going to come in and help you die sort of thing, but who also won't shy away from it either. So what do you do? You walk in, what do you do? Well, I think the best advice is to ask a couple good, open-ended questions. You walk in, you sit down, and one of the things you say is, are you going to be all right? Now, how open-ended is that? They can say, I'm going to be just fine. I'm taking my chemotherapy, and then I'm going to have radiation, and then I'm going to be fine. Or they may say, you know what? I'm not going to be fine. And nobody wants to hear that. And then you sit there, and you say, I'm here. And they may start to talk. Or maybe you say, can you tell me what's happening to you? And they may say, well, I have AIDS, and now I'm in the wasting process, but I'm taking AZT now and I'm going to be fine. Or they may say, I'm dying. And this is how angry I am about it. Or you may say, I really feel sad when I think about what's happening to you. And then you stop. And you may hear stories, you may hear feelings, you may hear fears, you may hear dreams, and you may hear nothing at all. But you have given an invitation and an opportunity, not to probe, but an invitation for openness. But the closer a person gets to death, the less able we are to sometimes interpret what they're saying. And the phenomena is, sometimes it sounds like gibberish. The next thing I want to talk about is the most predominant theme or event that these hospice nurses came across, and that's the presence of someone that we who are healthy couldn't see. Sometimes when people are near death, either a couple hours before they die or a couple days before they die, and sometimes even a week or so before they die, we will find them talking to someone that we can't see. Billy Graham's, anyone who took my class on angels already heard this story, but I apologize, but it's such a wonderful example that I have to use it again. Billy Graham's maternal grandmother was dying. She says, when my maternal grandmother died, for instance, the room became filled with a heavenly light. She sat up in bed and almost laughingly said, I see Jesus. Now leave it to Billy Graham's maternal grandmother to see three people, not just one. Most of us would have been happy with just one. She sees three. It goes on. And he has his arms outstretched to me, an invitation. Then she said, I see Ben. Ben was her husband that had died previous to her. And she said, and I see the angels. She fell over, absent to the body, but present to the Lord. So here in one swoop, she sees it all. I had a favorite patient by the name of Ruthie. And I was up on the floor, and as I said, I'm a hospital chaplain. Then I had the urology unit, and I walked in to see Ruthie. And Ruthie was a wonderful lady in her 80s, and we just were sitting down having this wonderful little conversation. And all of a sudden, as Ruthie was talking to me and telling me about her life, she looked right past me, and her eyes got really big, and she had this wonderful smile on her face. So I turned around because I thought a favorite person had walked in. There was nobody there. And then she's just kind of continued the conversation, so I continued listening to her. And then she did this again on the other side. And she got this great big face, and she smiled. And I said, Ruthie, what are you smiling at? Because I knew she wasn't smiling at me. She looked right by me. She says, incredulously, she said, well, Jesus. And I said, he's here? And she said, well, yes. And I said, what, is there anything else? And she said, oh, yes. She said, he has his arms outstretched to me. Now, I've heard that from three patients, and I think it's neat that that's what Billy Graham's maternal grandmother said. And I said, well, That must feel very comforting.
No, it does. It does. You know, just like this was an everyday occurrence, you couldn't believe it, couldn't see him.
And we continued talking, and this happened 4 times. Well, later I had a delightful time, and I want to tell you she was as coherent as any of you sitting in this room. So this woman was not seeing things that, you know, she wasn't hallucinating. Later that day I walked by the room, and there was a lot of commotion in there, so I went in, and Ruthie was very agitated. She was kind of comatose. She wasn't doing well. She wasn't responding. She was kind of groaning. And the nurses were running back and forth, starting IVs and putting stuff in it. And I said, what's going on? I said, we're not sure, but we think we might be losing her. And I said, I don't know if you two nurses are Christians, but I am. And this morning I was talking to Ruthie, and she saw Jesus. And I said, I don't know what that says to you, but I think that she might be leaving us, and I think that I would like to suggest to you that we call her family. And the nurse looked at me and said, I'm a Christian, and I know what you're talking about. I will call them. I had to leave. But I got a call later that night about 10 o'clock, and the nurse said, we've lost Ruthie. Would you come in? And I did, and her only family was 2 nieces and a spouse of that niece. And I said, she was already gone when I got there, and I said, I need to share a story with you. So I explained what I have just told you, and the tears just streamed down these 2 nieces' faces. And they said, we couldn't get here, you know, when we needed to. We weren't there for that phone call, but we are so grateful to know that, you know, Ruthie had her Lord here. And even though we weren't here, we know that he was here for her. So not only did Ruthie get a gift of seeing her Lord, but the family left behind got that final gift of knowing that she was taken care of that very day. A parallel story comes from this book, Final Gifts, and it was about Emma. And Emma was very agitated, and she said, if only I could relax. Now, I'm a Martha, and if somebody says to me, if only I could relax, I'd say, could I fluff your pillows? Could I get you a glass of water? Could I raise the bed? I mean, I do things for people. That's how I do. And this hospice nurse, in all her beautiful wisdom, said, what would happen if you relaxed? I would have never thought to ask that question. And she said, well, the light would get closer, and I would get to know all these people. Now, they were only the two of them were in the room. The hospice nurse, again, very relaxed, said, what people? And Emma looked surprised, as if I was asking a ridiculous question. And she said, well, all the people around my bed, of course, as she gestured to a full, almost 360-degree circle. Then the nurse knew it was her time to give reassurance, and she said, you will relax, Emma. This is a safe place. You will get to know all these people, and the light's going to get closer. So she knew the time to give that beautiful reassurance. I have a favorite story about Julie and Linda. Now, you're not supposed to have favorite patients, but Julie was one of mine. She was in her early 40s and had 2 small children, and she was dying of cancer. And she had said, as she'd come in and out of the hospital so many times, she had said, when I get better, I'm going to come and I'm going to help young mothers fight their way through this cancer. And unfortunately, Julie didn't get to do that in the way that she had hoped to, and she died. And she died in room 4412, and I tell you that because it's an important detail. About 6 weeks, 2 months later, Linda came in. And Linda was a mom with 2 young children. Julie's had been like 8 and 9, and Linda's were like 10 and 12. And Linda was really angry about the fact that she was dying. There was no peace about this. She was agitated. She was angry. She wasn't taking care of loose ends. She wasn't reconciled to this. She was just angry. And because of that, she was kind of alienating her children because they didn't quite understand this, and her husband was having a difficult time. It was hard for everybody. Well, she was getting closer and closer to death. And in our hospital, 4412 isn't a place down the hall that we send dying people. It's a beautiful room on a corner that has 2 walls of windows. It has a gorgeous view. It's a big room, and it's off the beaten path so that people aren't looking in as they walk by your room. You get privacy, and there's room for family members in there. Important. In the middle of the evening, late evening, 8 or 9 o'clock, The nurses had moved Linda into this room to give the family more privacy, and because the room she was in was small and dinky and dark. And in the middle of the night, she starts screaming, and she starts screaming, and the nurse comes running in. She says, "Linda, what's the matter?" She says, I don't want to be in here. There's too many dead people in this room. She had no idea that we use this room for final weeks for people. She had no idea. And the nurse said, "Linda, don't you worry. If you don't like this room, your old room is empty. We'll move you right back. Not a problem. Moved her back. The next morning, early, her husband came, and the nurse said, "You need to know that Linda had a terrible night. She was very agitated. She was talking. She was angry. We moved her back in." And he said, "Okay, I'll just go in." And when he went in, Linda said, "Well, I heard you had a bad night." She said, "Yes, it was awful. I was in that room. I didn't like it. There were too many dead people in there." But then she looked at him. She said, "But I'm fine now." And he said, "Well, that's great." He said, "What happened?" She said, "Well, Julie came." He said, "Who's Julie?" "I don't remember, honey, that we have any friend named Julie." Well, Julie came." And he said, "Is she a friend of yours?" He goes, "I don't know. She's just Julie, and she came." And he said, "Well, was it a nurse or was it a technician?" He goes, "It's just Julie, and I'm fine." She turned over and got out of the covers and went to sleep. So he went out and he went, "Did my wife have a friend this morning?" She said, "No, your wife hasn't had anybody," because her room was right across the nurse's station. He said, "Well, how about a nurse or a technician named Julie?" He said, "No, why?" So he told him this story. And the nurse's eyes got fairly large. And she said, "No one was in your wife's room this morning. She just woke up. And, but she's so calm." And through the next hours of the morning, when she woke up and she was starting to put her life together, taking care of things she had refused to take care of before, wanting to her children to come in, taking care of loose ends. And I went up on the floor about 11:30 and I was told this story. And I said, "I think I need to talk to you." And I took her husband aside and I said, "You need to know there was this patient, Julie, and I think what happened is that Julie perhaps came and talked to your wife." And then I Xeroxed the chapter in here about people seeing people who have died and coming and helping them in their transition from this world to the next. I can't verify any of that, but all I know is that having read this book and having read books like it, it seems to parallel so many situations where people are not ready to leave this world and someone comes back and helps them with that process. I hate to admit this, but when we moved from one campus to the next, we moved the whole oncology unit, I walked in that room, 4412, and I said, "Well, Julie, we're moving our unit to the other hospital, and I hope you're going to follow us." And it may be the strangest thing I've ever done, but I found out afterwards that the oncology pain specialist did the same thing about a half an hour after I did. So then I was supposed to. Some people see angels. Those of you who were here for my class before, I've told you the story of Tisha, who saw an angel all in white that came to be with her, a white that she said was so white it was white like lightning. And two of our other children that said they saw an angel outside of their window. And one little fellow who said, "Mom, an angel came to see me last night. I told him I wasn't ready." And a week and a half later, when this little fellow was in extreme pain, he was laying in his bed and he said, "Mom, when that angel comes again, is it okay if I go?" He said, "I know it'll be hard for you, but this time I think I need to go with him." And she said, "Honey, it's time, and you just take his hand and go for it." Sometimes people have gestures, and they're gesturing or smiling and waving at people we can't see. My next door neighbor was dying of cancer, and his wife was up with him all night long. And the wall in front of their bedroom was pretty bare, but she said he kept looking up and just smiling and kind of gesturing. And I said, what do you think? Because she had never heard this talk from me, and she'd never read this book. And she said, "I think he was waving at our son who had died about a year before of AIDS and some of those who have died before." She said, "I can't think of anything else because he was so at peace as he would look and wave," that she said things that I couldn't see. So it's a gift for us. It's a gift for us who are left behind when these things happen. And I think it's important, and it really, I'm not sure if it's in this book or if it's something I came up with or one of the other books, But I believe when people are dying that their reality expands. Now, you and I see what we see here. But when we're beginning to move spiritually from this world to the next, I believe that reality expands. And that's why, in the next thing I'm going to talk about, people talk about traveling and going places and seeing places we can't see. At this point, sometimes people get very distracted, they get glassy-eyed, they seem to get preoccupied, and they're very frustrated because they need to go someplace, and they think they need to get ready to go someplace, and they want us to know that they're going, and that they need us to say, it's okay to go. There was a patient from this final book's gift, a book, who... her name was Ellen, and she was in her early 20s, I believe, and she's being taken care of by her parents. They brought her home to die. And one day she was extremely agitated, and she kept saying three sentences over and over again. I want to go home. Where's the map? I'm lost. And she kept repeating these three sentences. And her parents were running around getting an atlas and putting up a world map. And finally the hospice nurse came. And they said, this is what's going on, and we don't know what to do. And she's getting more and more agitated all the time. And the hospice nurse said, do you have another summer home that she might want to go to? She said, no, this is our only home. The nurse said, are you Christians? The mom said, yeah. And we talk about heaven as our other home. And the nurse said, I think you figured it out. And so the mother and father went into the room and took Ellen's hand and said, Ellen, you're going to find the map. You'll find your way home. We now understand what's happening, and we'll be here for you. And she immediately settled down. She just had to have that reassurance that they knew she was on the journey and they were going to help her through it. I had a patient about a year and a half ago, and I was talking to the daughter. A lot of my work is not just with the patients, but with their family. And this daughter was telling me about her mom, who was sleeping at the time, and she said, but she's driving me nuts. She said, there are times she's totally coherent, and we have these wonderful conversations, and there are times when she wakes up, and she keeps screaming to me, I've got to get the dishes done. I've got to do the dishes. I've got to do the dishes. And thank goodness I had read this book, and I said, is your mother the sort of person that whenever she leaves her house, she has to have the dishes done, the counter clean, and the house tidied up? She said, yes. She's a fanatic about it. And I said, I'm going to suggest something. It may work, it may not. But the next time she's in one of these coherent moods, and ask her if there's anything that she wants you to bring to the hospital to take care of unfinished business, a checkbook or bills or a will or, you know, anything that she would have to tidy up before she leaves this world. And I talked to the woman about a week later, and I said, oh, by the way, you know, how did this go? And she said, I did what you said. She told me to bring this, this, and this. We took care of this, this, and this. She never brought up the dishes again. But what had happened in it is she kept saying to Mom, Mom, they do the dishes downstairs. And so in her insistence that, you know, this is a hospital, Mom, we don't have to worry about the dishes, it was only escalating the frustration because the symbolic language wasn't understood. So we give them that gift by listening and using the metaphor in a new way. And if we don't understand what the metaphor is, maybe even asking them, what do you mean by that, Mom? Along with seeing people we can't see and seeing places, sometimes somebody will say, it's so beautiful. That's all they'll say. You say, what's so beautiful? I can't tell you, but it's so beautiful. And there's a white light. Often their descriptions are very brief, very simple, very glowing, and they don't usually say much. You may say, tell me more, because we would really like to know more, right? And they say, I can't, and then they just oftentimes smile. But they see glimpses, and it brings them a real feeling of peace and comfort. Bobby was a 32-year-old who was dying. He was being cared for by his brother and sister. He was scared of dying. And what he needed was information on what was going to happen when he died. So the hospice nurse sat down with him and said, this, and he had cancer, and he said, this is what I think is going to happen. And then she went through the steps of what she thought would happen to him in his dying process. And one of the things she said, I believe that you'll go into a coma. We'll make sure we keep you comfortable. We'll give you plenty of morphine, et cetera, et cetera. That's exactly what happened to him. And he went into a coma, and he was in a coma for about 3 days. And then he opened his eyes, and he looked out to the end of his room, and he said, I can see down the road, and it's beautiful. And he had this smile on his face, and then he died. The beauty of this situation is, after he died, the brother and sister called the priest. And they told the priest what had happened. Now, he'd been in a coma, and then they just woke up and said this. And the priest, in all his lovely knowledge, said, what do you think he was telling you? And Bill, the brother, said, he must have been seeing heaven. And then the beautiful thing the priest said, our Christian faith is based on the suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus, the priest said. You've witnessed your brother's suffering and his death, and now he has given you a glimpse of his resurrection, which I thought was a beautiful thing for the priest to tie it all together. Sometimes we just have to say, you know, what home are you going to? Or are you ready to leave? Can you tell me about it? To make sure that everything is kind of okay for their departing. And again, we are reaffirming their reality by going along with whatever they're saying. Sometimes people know when their death is going to occur. And usually they can face it without fear and without panic, but with a kind of a beautiful resignation as well, this is the way my life is going and I know it's going to end here. There was a cancer patient that I had this winter, was 79, and one of his goals was to live to be 80. And when I was in visiting his wife, the first time, he was laying in bed, and I thought he was in a coma. He was laying in bed just as still as could be, and his wife and I were conversing, and she said something about, well, my bedroom is at the top of the stairs, and this little voice said, our bedroom. And I kind of went, I mean, I didn't even know he was listening. She said, okay, dear, our bedroom. You know, so he was listening to everything, but he was saving his energy. And whenever I saw him, he was just in this very quiet state. Well, he turned 80. And he said, today's my 80th birthday. I'm going to celebrate my 80th birthday. That's all I wanted to do is live to be 80, and then I'm going to die. And his wife kind of went, oh my gosh. And so she gathered in the family. He said, call my children, have a party, and I want them all to come and celebrate with me. They did. Bought balloons, cakes. They had a party. He went and said goodbye to each of his family members and his spouse. That afternoon, he started sleeping. More, this time, not just in this quiet state, but he started sleeping. By that evening, he was in kind of a semi-comatose state, and 3 days later, he had died. When people say, you die when your time is up, I would contest that, because we have a whole lot of control of when we're going to die. Michael had muscular dystrophy, and he was in his 20s, and when people have muscular dystrophy, I guess they often have pneumonia, which I didn't know. And so he would end up in the hospital, he would be treated, and then go back. And he was going to college. He had a wonderful family, very supportive, and wonderful friends in this university that he went to that would help him get around and get to classes and so on. Well, he ended up in the hospital with this pneumonia. One afternoon, he got on the phone, and he called, first of all of his family members. He told them how much he loved them and how much he had appreciated what they had done for him. And they thought that kind of strange because they, well, you know, Michael, we're going to be here tonight. And he said, I know what I wanted to say is. And then he called up his college friends. And if he couldn't get a hold of them, he left little messages on the machine. And he said, thanks. You know, you made my going to college possible because of what you did. He said, well, Michael, you didn't have to call me. You know, we'll be there tonight. That night when everybody got off work and done with classes and went to see Michael, he was in a coma. And he died a short time after that. And I think the beauty of that is a person can prepare themselves and they can use the time that they have left so that they are a participant in this final event of life. And they can use their time well, and he did. Kind of the second category that I want to talk about is when somebody needs something to happen before they can die peacefully. Perhaps they need a reconciliation with someone. Perhaps they have to have someone there and they'll wait till that person gets there. I had a death just a month ago. The person was hanging on, the blood pressure was dropping, and we were waiting for this son to get there. And, you know, I said, that person will hang on. I know that person will hang on until that son got there. That son got there. I said, your mother is dying. You need to talk to her. She needs to hear your voice. Go in, take her hand and talk to her. And within 4 minutes, she died. People can wait till that loved one gets there. Sometimes they need certain circumstances set up. They need a barrier removed. Probably my hardest story to get through is Debbie. She was a 23-year-old who said to me the first time I met her, Jeannie, I just want to live long enough to have my 4-year-old remember me. Debbie was in and out of the hospital. She was unmarried, had a wonderful set of parents, got sicker and sicker and sicker. I was leaving to go to Arizona, and well, I'll go back. Every Friday when I left the hospital, I'd go in and say goodbye to Debbie because I knew Debbie was not going to be alive when I came back. She had gotten so much worse. She was so skinny. She was just a skeleton of a person. And every Friday I'd say goodbye to her. And then I'd come back, and on Monday she was still there. So I'd say goodbye to her to the next Friday, knowing she couldn't possibly live. And there she was the next Monday. I mean, she was going to make sure she lived as long as she possibly could. It was unbelievable determination and guts. Well, I was going to Arizona, and I knew because I was going to be gone a week, she would be dead. So I went in and gave my teary goodbye. While I was in Arizona, I read this book. I had gotten it at Holden in the summer, but I hadn't read it yet. So I read this book. When I came back from Arizona, Debbie was still alive. And I went up to see her, and by now she was so skeletal that you could see into her eye sockets. You could see, the eyes were here, but the sockets were here, and you could see in them. Every bone in her face was like there was only a saran wrap over it. And I said to her, Mom, what's keeping Debbie here? I said, I just happened to read a book. And I said, no human being lingers and clings to life like Debbie does. What's keeping her here? And she said, I don't know, but I can't stand seeing her suffer any longer. And I said, do I have your permission to ask her what's keeping her here? She said, yes, but I can't be there, but I want to know. And so they went out, and I went in, and Debbie was sitting in a chair, barely. And I got down next to her, and I said, Debbie, you know, you have fought so hard for life. I'm going to make this short. But I said a lot of things. I said, I know you're a Christian. I know you're not afraid of dying. I know you've done what you need to do with your daughter. I know that, you know, you have been struggling, and I know you're suffering now. And I want to ask you a question. What's holding you back? Is there something else that you need to do or to have done before you can let go? And she was so weak, she tried to tell me, and I couldn't understand her. It was like, oh, Lord, come on, I have to hear this. But I grabbed a piece of paper and a pencil, and I said, Debbie, I can't understand you. Please write it out. And she wrote out, they're bringing her. And I sat back, and by now her mother had come in. And I knew why they hadn't been bringing Letitia to the hospital, because Debbie looked awful. And Letitia was only 5 now. And I said, Debbie, I said, this illness hasn't been kind to you. And I said, the beautiful Debbie that you are isn't the Debbie that you are now, because this illness has been so cruel. And your parents, and now the mother was sitting next to me and she's nodding, I said, your parents haven't brought Letitia because we thought it would be too upsetting for Letitia to see you. And the mother is affirming everything I'm saying. And I said, but if that's what it takes for you to be able to die peacefully, we'll prepare her. And she sat back in the chair and she said, no, now I understand. And we could lip read that. And within 24 hours, Debbie died. And I would have never had the guts to ask that question if I hadn't read this book. Sometimes people are more upfront with their requests and their needs, and it makes it a whole lot easier. Sometimes when I have an experience that's kind of so overwhelming to me and I learned so much or it was so intimate or I felt it was sacred ground, I have to write it because I have to, as a chaplain, and many of you are in professions perhaps where things are so emotional or you have an experience that's so emotional in your life that you have to what we call debrief it and you have to talk to somebody about it. I do this with my head chaplain, who's also one of my best friends, but sometimes I also write it. And this is what I did in this experience. I was called up the intensive care unit, and the nurse said to me, "I need you. There's a woman who's only 52 years old. She's dying of heart and lung problems. She's a DNR, do not resuscitate, and she wants to talk, and her husband and son are with her. She's in room one." I entered the room and I introduced myself, and she looked at me between difficult breaths and she said the very first words, "I can't go on anymore, it's just too hard." "You've been through a lot," I said to her, and I took her hand. "Yes," she said, "and I'm too tired to fight anymore." Her husband and her son nodded to me, affirming her long, hard struggle. They talked about her illness, its history, and its how long she had been going through this. Then she said, "I just want to die." I said, "Judy, we will do everything we can to make this easy for you." And I had read the book, so I said, "What do you need to be able to die peacefully?" She thought only for a moment, and she said, "I need to talk to my four other children and my father." I nodded to her husband, "Can you arrange that?" He nodded, "Yes." But I knew there was more questions to ask, and I said, "What do you need from them?" "I need them to give me their blessing that my dying is okay with them and that they can let me go. I witnessed the awful scene once of a wife who wouldn't let her husband go." And it's an awful scene. And this woman was smart enough to know she needed their blessing and their okay. I looked at her husband and her eldest son, and they both nodded with tears in their eyes. "Judy, your husband will arrange for your family to come." She seemed to relax a bit, and I knew that such and such was her Methodist church, and it was listed on her admit, and I said, "Is there a pastor you'd like me to get?" She said, "We don't know him very well. He's new." And we went on to discuss how important it would be to have that minister come, get to know her, and get to know her family members, because he would be doing the service and the funeral. So she agreed to that. But she was still really tense. And I said, "Judy, are you afraid of what lies ahead?" She nodded and she took my other hand. And I said, "Would you like me to share with you what may happen to you as you approach your transition from this world to the next?" She nodded. I then shared with her the physical slowdown of her body, how the nurses and doctors would do everything they could to keep her comfortable, and how finally her spirit would lift from her body, going from this world to the next. I asked her who had died previous to her, and she said that her mother and a son. And I asked her if she would like a prayer for her peaceful transition from this world to the next. We made a circle with her son and her husband, and I prayed some prayer to that effect. She laid her head back on the pillow and she sighed. She seemed relaxed for the very first time. "I'm tired now," she said as she closed her eyes. I turned to her husband and said, "May I suggest that we ask for a private room up on the floor so that you can have your whole family together as much as possible? Intensive care doesn't allow that. And you need to know that as family members, if a loved one is dying in intensive care and you don't need all that machinery anymore, you have the right to ask for a private room where you would have more privacy to be with your loved one. But that would be nice." I went out, talked to the head nurse, called the minister, and I am told that Judy died peacefully 1.5 days later in a private room surrounded by her family. In that case, all we needed to do was ask and then carry out what she needed. For some people, they need a reconciliation with God. Sometimes they need a priest to come. They need to receive the sacrament of Holy Communion. If they're Catholic, they may need absolution. They may need a prayer. They may need to talk with someone because maybe they were a Vietnam vet and they never told anyone what they did and what they experienced in Vietnam. I mean, we've had situations like that where they needed to share something that they've carried as a burden their whole lives. Some people need to heal relationships with family members or friends. Sometimes they need to express gratitude or an apology or have an apology accepted. Sometimes the stories are harder, and the stories are sometimes harder when they're AIDS patients. Bill was a 27-year-old that was dying of AIDS. The mother said, I'm going to bring him home to die. Dad said, if you bring him home, I'm leaving. And he did. So mother took care of her dying AIDS victim's son. And he hung on and he hung on and he hung on. And one day the priest came to him and said, Bill, I don't understand this. He said, you're hanging on for, and it seems so difficult. Do you need to see your dad? And his eyes lit up and he nodded yes, because at this point he couldn't talk. And so the priest went and begged, I might add, the father to come home and be with his son. The father said no. That poor young man held on for 2 more weeks, and finally, too exhausted to hang on any longer, he died. And one of his friends at the funeral said, you know, death isn't the worst thing, but estrangement is. The blessing of unconditional love couldn't be given in that situation. As caregivers, as family members, we want to make that death peaceful, and sometimes we aren't at this scene where death is so imminent, and we can step back. Maybe we know someone who has been told, you have cancer, it's terminal, we're going to stop radiation and chemo, but death is a ways away. And there are some things that we can do. Or maybe some of you visit people in nursing homes, people who are older, and we know they're nearing death, but they're not there yet. What can we do as they get closer to death? Everyone needs to know that their life has been significant and it's meant something, that they've made a difference. And the important thing for us to do is to go through life review with them. So how do we do it? We can do it orally. Tell me about when you were, you know, your first recollection as a kid. And this little 89-year-old lady starts to tell you about her life. The next time we go, we say, tell me about your life as a teenager. Now, the other thing we can do is put it on tape so that we have this recorded. One of our befrienders, who are lay people who are volunteers and go in rooms to do this in the hospital and also take care of hospice patients, what she did is she went to the visit person. She said, tell me about your first life experience. And as the patient told it, she wrote it down. And she went home and she typed it on her computer. And then she went and said, okay, tell me your life as a teenager. Wrote that chapter out as she told it, went home, put it on the computer. By the time she finished this whole person's life, she had her whole book. She had a book of this person's life. She Xeroxed it, bound it, and gave it to each family member and gave a copy to the person who was dying. There was this person's life, bound and given to each of their family members. I can't think of a more wonderful gift to give someone. Sometimes you can use pictures as a life review. We have a friend who died in Eugene, Oregon, and he called his 2 children home. He was dying of throat cancer. And they went through every family album from the time he was a little kid and told about life experiences, and they laughed and they told stories for 3 days and went through every album through his entire life. You know, then his early marriage, and then when the children came along, and then the children's high school days and all his accomplishments as a famous coach in Eugene. Did the life review, and the 2 kids told me it was 3 of the most important days of their lives. Another thing to do is there was a mom, this was in Final Gifts, who was dying and leaving behind 3 small children. So what she did is that she took 3 baby books and picture albums, and she put together the pictures of all 3 of her children and wrote a letter to each child, because she knew that it would be hard for these children, as young as they were, to be able to remember her. And she gave them to those children. One of my best friend's sister was dying, and she was in her mid-30s, and she was leaving behind 3 children. And when she got near to the end, she had written a letter to each of the children when she was still able to do so. And then one night she said to her husband, go to Toys R Us and find a stuffed animal or a doll that you think most closely represents our children's personalities, and buy them and bring them to me tonight. And so when he left and she had these 3 stuffed animals, I don't know if I can tell this story. She took each animal and she held it and she cuddled it and she talked to it and she snuggled it. And she did that with each of the children, thinking about them, praying for them. And the next morning when he came back, she said, put these in a closet with the letters. And the day of my funeral, You give each of the children their stuffed animal or doll and the letter that goes with it, so that they always know that when they can't hug me and they have difficult times in life, they go back and hug that animal or doll that has represented. And the husband did a neat thing. He chose a perfect animal or doll for each of the kids, and the kids have that. Then that death was just about a year ago. Sometimes people need a particular person present when they die, or sometimes they'll make sure that everyone's gone when they die. And believe it or not, it's usually children who say to me, you know, my mom can't handle the fact that I'm going to die, and neither can my dad. And those will oftentimes be the children. Mom's been there for 3 weeks and never left that bedside except to take a shower and get coffee. And she'll walk down to the nurse's station to get coffee, and that child will die. And she'll say, but I was here every day, Jeannie. And I'll say, that child wanted to spare you, and that was their final gift to you, is that you were not present for that death. And the child feels like they're giving that parent a gift in that death. Sometimes they have to wait for a particular date. There was a young woman who was a high school senior, and she said to her parents, I can't die in this week because there's the prom, and there's also graduation, and I don't want to ruin my friend's week. The day after graduation, prom was over, graduation was over, the parties were over. She died. Again, I say, we have a lot of control over when we die. Sometimes it's time, sometimes it's circumstances, sometimes it's people present. There was a woman who was dying, and I'll forget that story, I need to move on. One of the most important things, and this is the last thing I'm going to talk about, is if we can be there and we have the privilege of being there at the moment that person is dying, to help them in their transition from this world to the next. I was called into a room. The woman's name was Carol. And I hadn't met this woman before, even though the oncology floor is my floor. For some reason, I hadn't connected with this woman. And Janet, the nurse, called me and she said, Carol is dying. She's not responding. She may have had a stroke. She's in a coma, semi-comatose state. Her husband's there. Her parents are here. She's 47 years old. She's a do not resuscitate. So I walked in, and she had her head back, and her eyes were kind of open but staring at nothing. And her mother was standing by her and just stroking her face and stroking her forehead and kind of talking to her. So I went over and started talking to her mother. And her mother started telling me about Carol and who she was and what her life was like and what her family was like and just kind of who she was. And all of a sudden, Carol became extremely agitated. And she was kind of thrashing around. And I asked one of the family members to go get the nurse. So the nurse came in. And she was getting more and more agitated. And her father came in, and her husband came in. Her husband came over and took her hand and started talking to her. Nothing seemed to be happening. And I sensed that maybe this was kind of it for Carol. And I looked at the nurse who was not coming in, and she was trying to do some stuff with the tubes. And I could tell she was going to try and give her a shot, but things weren't working. And I'm not a nurse, so I don't understand all the mechanics of it, but things weren't working over there with all these tubes. And I said to her mom, could I talk to her? I think we might be close. And her mom said, please. And so I went over and I took Carol's hand. And I said, Carol, I know this is another time I had to write this out. And I can't even actually read my notes, so I'll have to decipher as I go along, because I wrote it that same day. I said, Carol, I know this isn't easy. In fact, I know it's really hard. And I know you're scared. And I know things aren't going like you hoped they were. And I know you're having trouble breathing, and you're scared. But Mary Lou, your nurse, is right here, and she is going to give you a shot. And it's going to be something that is going to calm you. And I'm looking at Mary Lou, assuming that this is right, and she's nodding back to me. I said, we're having a little trouble with that, but you're going to get a shot, and it's going to calm you down. You may even feel sleepy. We're going to take care of you. And if we feel like you're in pain, you can tell us. We're going to give you a shot of morphine. And by now, Mary Lou was taking her
blood pressure, and I could see that things weren't going well there. And I could sense that her color was changing. And I said to her mother, I think this is it. May I go on and talk to her? And she said, yes. And I said, Carol, this may be your time. And I said, and we're going to make that as easy as possible for you. I said, your blood pressure is going to start dropping, and your breath is going to become slower. And this, when this shock comes in, as I said before, you're going to start drifting away from us. And I know you don't want to leave. And I know you don't want to leave life, and I know you don't want to leave your family, your husband. And I mentioned the people who were in the room. I said, they're all here for you, Carol. I said, but pretty soon you're going to take a breath in this world, and then you're going to take a breath in the next. And you'll have made the transition, and it's not going to be as hard as you think. You'll be leaving your earthly body. You'll leave pain behind. You'll leave behind this labored breathing, and you'll be able to move with freedom in the new body that the Lord's going to give you. And then I said, Carol, I know you happen to be a Catholic, and I know that you're going to understand what I say here, because Catholics have a better understanding of angels than most of us Protestants, and you've probably prayed a little prayer. And her mother's nodding to me and kind of laughing, actually. I said, you've probably been praying a prayer about an angel watching over you. And I said, I believe that angels are here, and that that escort angel is going to be here to help you move from this world to the next. And at this point, she had had her head back, and her eyes, as I said, were not focused, but really agitated. And by now, she had calmed down. And as I was talking to her, her head, which had been thrust back, was now moving forward in a very deliberate way. And I said, I think you're going to see a bright light, and you're going to be drawn to that light, because that light is God's presence coming closer to you. And I said, again, I said, I know you don't want to leave this family, but you're going to have a new family. And I didn't know who had died before, but I said, those who have died before are going to be able to greet you. And by now, her head was down, and I was on the side of her bed, and she moved her head over, and was now, her eyes were totally and completely locked with mine. No fear, no agitation, she's just staring at me. And I said, and you'll be home. And now I'm going to touch you, and I'm going to touch your forehead. And I'm going to make the sign of a cross on your forehead, because I know you have been baptized. And I looked at her mother, and she's nodding to me. And I said, you were signed and sealed with the cross of Christ in your baptize, when you were baptized. You were declared his with this sign. And I made the sign. And you can rest in that peace as God's child. Don't be afraid. It'll be easier than you think. I hesitate to call it death, Carol. And now I'm stroking her face, because it's not an end. It's just the beginning of a new life and a better one. And I looked at Mary Lou now, who is taking her blood pressure, and I looked at her like we're losing her, and she's nodding to me, yes. So I keep talking to her. I'm repeating some of what I've just said to her. She's holding my gaze, and she seems to be at peace, and all of a sudden, she loses the gaze, and her head falls to the side. By now, tears are streaming down my face, and I know she's gone, and I look at Mary Lou, and she nods, and I turn around, and tears are streaming down her mother's face, and we embrace. At that point, I knew it was just time for me to exit. I embraced her husband and her parents, and I walked out of the room. And the head nurse was sitting at the desk, and she's not a Christian. And she looked at me and she said, well, I hear you're a midwife. And I looked at her and I'm not getting this at all. And she said, I hear you midwifed Carol from this world to the next. And I looked at her and I thought she had given me the greatest compliment I had ever had. And I said, I guess so. And I walked down to my office. And the closer I got to my office, the more guilty I felt. By the time I walked in my best friend and head chaplain's office and closed the door, I said, I feel so guilty.
I told him the story of what had happened in a very short version, and I said, her husband was there, and her mother was there who gave her birth, and her father was there, and I had her gaze at the end. And I talked her through her transition. I said, it's not fair. That wasn't my place to do that. And he looked at me in all his wonderful wisdom, and I truly love him. And he looked at me and he said, Jeannie, did her mother or her husband know how to do that? And I said, I don't think so. And he said, well, then you are the only one to do it. And what did her mother say to you when she hugged you? And she had said to me, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And I said, she couldn't have done it, but she was witness to it. As I walked out of his office, I remembered the last chapter of this book. And that's why I teach this class. This last chapter says, most important, don't give in to the understandable temptation to be in the middle of this exciting communication.